The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Welcome to the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick. Brunch is being served. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime,
Patrick Martins. Thanks for having me, Katie.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Patrick. And our guest today
is
very
Carmen.
Excited.
Do you know how to pronounce his last name?
No.
Quagliata.
Quagliata.
Ooh.
Quagliata.
No? Quagliata.
Ah, there you go.
Quagliata. Si, from Union Square Cafe, one of New York's most venerable, respected, and beloved restaurants.
It's a real institution.
Totally.
It's actually started, maybe, you
what
could
What is it, like 25 years, Carmen?
25 years. We're celebrating
from
this.
Green Market and all that. I mean,
the whole thing.
You could maybe say
I took my mother there, like 15 years ago.
You should bring her back.
She's dead now.
I'm sorry.
You should still bring her back. That's the type
I would
of
love
restaurant
that.
Union Square
right.
is.
We have a table for
resurrect
her.
The dead at Union Square Cafe.
Well, it's great to be here. Nice to
Thanks
see you, Patrick.
So much. Yeah, nice to see you, Carmen. I've known you for about a decade. And
it seems like we only talk on the phone.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
It's great to see you in the flesh. So, Carmen, you have had an amazing career. Amazing. Now, you're an upstate New York boy
mm-hmm.
from like outside of Binghamton. And you just like knew from the get-go that you were interested in cooking and wanted to be a chef. Tell us a little bit about your trajectory.
Was it all those great restaurants in Binghamton?
Yeah, right?
No, actually, it was just my family and the great tables that we ate at. And we couldn't wait to go to my grandmother's on Sunday to eat. And, you know, my mother worked hard and didn't cook a lot like me and my wife do now. But there was always some sort of love and care from when we did sit down and eat. I just love to be around food. I didn't know I wanted to be a chef until I was a dishwasher. It was mm-hmm. a part-time job. And I loved...
So that was like your after-school job?
Yeah, that was I was an athlete that wasn't good enough to be a varsity athlete, pretty much. And I just loved that team aspect when my friends and I got this job. And I thought, you know, this is so exciting.
It's like a pirate ship in there, right?
Yeah,
what kind of
exactly.
restaurant was the first restaurant you worked in?
It was a banquet house across the street from my high school.
Sweet.
Yeah. And
so you did big catering events.
Big catering. Right. And I was so fast at washing dishes, I guess. The chef just kind of called me into the kitchen one day and taught me how to use a knife. And it was all...
Really?
So now Binghamton is on the western tier. Kind of it goes over Pennsylvania a little bit.
Exactly.
Of New York State.
Yeah. It's sort of like right dead center.
There's
of
a big
state.
SUNY
on the Pennsylvania border. Yeah, SUNY Binghamton.
Big SUNY Binghamton campus.
So, yeah.
There.
And then so you just were like drawn and you're like, Dad, Mom, I'm going to go work in a restaurant, because you had grown up eating 7 days a week at home with a Sicilian grandmother? Or like what was
No,
it
just happened to be the job I could get close to school. I didn't have a car. Had no intention of being a chef. And then about a year after that, I had every intention in the world of being a chef.
Right. And
what
did
kind
you,
of
did you go to CIA?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Here in Hyde Park.
Hyde Park. Yeah.
Yep.
What foods did you grow up eating? I mean, pasta or
a lot of pasta. A lot of what my one of my uncles calls Sicilian soul food.
Huh.
You know, just a lot of beans and olive oil and olives, and I cook a lot like that still today.
Mm-hmm.
That's things like that always show up.
What kind of beans? Like gigante and...
Well, I love gigante now. Actually, they're on the menu with a tuna dish at the restaurant. But chickpeas was a big thing. And lentils.
Right.
That's...
Which is not something that you naturally associate with Italian cooking, is it?
It's so funny because I was just saying Sicily is probably 2 miles from Middle Eastern cuisine, you know,
right.
in Northern Africa. And yet, you know, it is like I was surprised too when I heard those ingredients get mentioned because, you know... that 5 mile difference between Sicily and, you know, is a whole different cuisine, really.
But the Sicilians also have that agrodolce, and they use a lot of raisins and capers and pine nuts and stuff, which I think is quite distinct from other regions of Italian, cuisine.
It is. You know, those things didn't really show up in my childhood at my grandmother's table. That's something I went out and explored.
So caponata was not like a staple in your house and stuff?
Well, you know, they called caponata anything that was had eggplant and was basically marinated with other vegetables from the garden, but it didn't have quite so much sweet and sour going on. And I love that flavor profile.
I know, me too.
Yeah.
And that's so typically Sicilian. And then I think of that as being very North African, actually.
Yeah.
Very much influenced by the Moorish, by the infidels coming in.
The infidels.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, they think of us as infidels. But anyway, so after you graduated from CIA, you went south or you went west first?
The next logical step, West Virginia, where all great chefs go after.
That
had to be an education
that comes
in itself.
About because I was so young when I went to the CIA. I realized.
Yeah, you were 17 or 18?
I was 18. I think I graduated right after my 19th birthday. And I thought, wow, I don't know anything. I really just, all I did was go to a lot of classes, and they were great classes. I don't mean to downplay the importance of my education.
You graduated CIA at 19?
Yeah, CIA at 19.
Hey, Carmen, you need to speak right into your microphone.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. But I thought I need to take everything I learned there and then do a lot more of it for a longer period of time. And there was a great apprenticeship program at the Greenbrier Hotel.
Famous Greenbrier.
Yeah, with a chef who I met up at school, Hartman Henke, who I love and still love and adore. I haven't talked to him in a while. I probably should reach out to him, but he taught me so much. And I was out in the country, and I loved being close. The butchers took me to the West Virginia State Fair once, and we were feeling the lamb, and he said, "This has a good fat cap here," or something, as I grabbed its haunch, and we're gonna buy 100 of these. And it was an amazing experience. I didn't think I was gonna find that there, and people were really into the food, and I learned a lot. I took the techniques I learned at school and did them over and over again, and got
when
better.
Was this in the early 90s?
Early 90s, yeah. So I graduated, I guess you could say, from that apprenticeship program, and I felt like I really had the tools to then be able to go into a kitchen and really
work,
know what I was doing. Yeah.
And then from there to Naples.
Yeah, that was in between the seasons at the Greenbrier.
Naples, Italy, or Naples, Florida?
Naples, Florida. I worked for Ritz-Carlton Hotels, which was a unique experience. I'd never worked for a big hotel, but this was back when Ritz-Carlton had like 8 hotels.
Yeah.
And it was felt like this super high-end mom-and-pop hotel company.
But it was super high-end.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like the ne plus ultra of the hotel. Everybody thought of the Ritz-Carlton as like the best and the brightest,
It meant
right?
gastronomy. It
meant great elegance and history, tradition.
And to this day remain the only place where you can do anything. You can like get room service. You can be in one restaurant and get food from the other one. Like a hotel is still an all-service mentality
for
the guests.
So, if they want to stay in business, that's right.
Now, what was the state of Italian food in places like West Virginia and Naples, Florida, back in the early 90s, if existent at all?
Oh, I wasn't even looking for it.
Uh-huh.
I was just trying to work and learn as much as I could.
So what was the idiom in which you worked most? French?
Yeah, I guess you could say it was French or American.
Continental. What they used to call continental.
Yeah. You know, the Greenbrier was born for building solid technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that from the mentors I had and people I'd spoken to at school, that was something you had to have and could stay with you. You could do build anything on that.
Mm-hmm.
So
very cool. And then you came from those places. How did you hook up with Trevigna? I mean, and how did you go from Naples or West Virginia to the heart of American kind of gastronomy there in California?
I had always been in touch with that. When I was young, I used to love to watch a little bit of food TV, I guess, Jan Kahn Cook and Julia Child and Wolfgang Puck was another chef that kept showing up on
TV.
That
was like the very beginning of the
very beginning. And I identified with California. And of course, Alice Waters, you hear about it. There's people in my life that came to me and said, "Hey, this is what you need to be looking at. These are the people you need to be reading about." Not
right. Jonathan Waxman.
Exactly.
Alice Waters.
And I decided I'm from New York. I probably will be in New York again someday, which I guess did turn out, but I have to go to California. And I just packed up my car and drove out there with nothing. And,
oh, cool.
And,
like Fievel.
Yeah. Right.
Totally.
I wish I was light as Fievel. But that was a great experience. And it wasn't that I think it was within a year of the big earthquake in 89 that I arrived, and I couldn't find a job in San Francisco. Yeah. And
that was during the World Series, right? Oakland
right.
was in the World Series, I believe. And they
only a boy
died.
Would
that was
know
very
that.
Serious earthquake. Yeah, the Bay Bridge got screwed up.
It
everything.
Got screwed up, and I wasn't thinking of that. You know, I just thought, okay, I'm going to go there and cook, and I couldn't find a job at that time. You know, that happens sometimes. You know, there's not any openings, or maybe you didn't hit the right restaurant on the right day. And I was young, and I was crashing on the floor with some friends in their apartment, and he said, you know, there's this place I deliver fish to. This guy told me it's Trevina, and the chef is so passionate, and he's a madman. You have to go.
Who was the chef?
That was Michael Curello.
Michael Curello.
Yeah, who I went up there and got a job, started cooking, and I never stopped learning.
Wow.
Tell us about Trevina and its place in the kind of hierarchy of Northern California restaurants, because I've heard a lot of people mention it. A lot of people have come through that place.
It when I got there, it was 4 years old, and it felt like it was leaving its infancy and moving towards something bigger and better and greater. And I felt like the crew that was there at the time, the people I was cooking with, and the farmers that we were using and the meat that we were using was a really unique time. And it was just we were hell bent on just cooking our butts off every day. And it was just a dynamic period. And I think for about 5 or 6 or 7 years there, and then the French Laundry opened up, and it felt like to me the two very different but important dining experiences to have in Napa were Trevina and the French Laundry.
What characterized Trevina versus the French Laundry, since you obviously both restaurants had that emphasis on local and you know, buying, you know, picking things in the garden and bringing them right into the restaurant and stuff like that?
I think the difference was the two people running those restaurants. Chiarello's food and Thomas's food were very different, but they were going to the same sources to get that flavor. Mm-hmm. Our way of delivering the flavor was just definitely different than Thomas's.
But Trevina wasn't as expensive, was it?
No.
Okay,
not at all.
Yeah, it was more of
so
an
it was
everyday.
More of an everyday person's event.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, we had our menu didn't change from seeing the wine country. People get the tasting rooms at that time. I'll find out next week because I'm going, but they closed at 4 o'clock, and then everyone would come to restaurants sloshed wanting to have a 4-course meal, and we had it. We had the menu ready, you know. It was and I remember
you knew just what to give them. Bread.
Yeah.
Well, start off with a large appetizer of bread.
it was then some
protein.
It was amazing. We would be cooking, like the lunch cooks would walk offline at 5 o'clock with a full board, and the dinner cooks would walk on to maybe some slight menu changes, but the way people ordered would change, but we would have the dinner menu available all the time. It was a very, very busy restaurant. Very busy.
And what would you do? So you walk in, what type of jobs does a walk-on chef get? You know, like, are you just shucking oysters for 10 hours? Or, like, what's your...
Well, I went through a lot of that at the Greenbrier, and I also got to a point at the Greenbrier where I was working on some of the fine dining line positions in the hotel that maybe apprentices didn't always get to do. So maybe, fortunately or unfortunately for me, I said to Michael Chiarello, I can work your line after my... interview or after my trail.
Wowee.
And then the way I said it, it might have pissed him off a little bit.
And
thinking,
he was like,
who's
okay,
this guy?
Let me throw this guy to the dog.
So he did. And I started working the pasta station, which they called the saute station, because we did a lot of roasted meats and things just as a side, and some hot apps. Like everything got thrown onto that part of the line. And it was probably the hardest two months of my career, and probably the best, the most formative of how I work and the commitment to doing things perfectly.
What was the tone of the kitchen? Off a trajectory, but like how did Michael's style, how did he, you know, run his kitchen? Was it like boisterous and a pirate crew, or was it really quiet and serious? Or,
well, it was very serious, and when service started it had to be very quiet, but there was always an edge to it, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And he was a disciplinarian. And
did he ever smack you on the back of the head? We heard some horrible stories from some chefs.
Oh, we had a chef on last week.
Oh, no.
Grew up in the French tradition where, you know, you get like whacked on the back of the head by Paul Bocuse because...
No, I never got whacked, but you were made to identify moments in cooking that, you know, you just don't make that compromise.
Yeah.
No matter what.
And what were they worried about? Like you would send out a dish that wasn't right, or you would undercook a steak, or...
I guess they just wanted to prepare you for them to be able to turn their back and know that you had, you know, characters doing the right thing when no one's looking.
Right.
And line cooks have to have amazing character. And I still what line cooks do and what they go through and the job they do, it's still, I still have amazing respect for
Well,
them.
At Union Square Cafe, and we were talking about this a little earlier, you had a wonderful analogy about like the difference, you know, that 5% difference in what you do as a line cook has an impact on the restaurant overall. So let's talk a little bit about that. Like, I think, you know, people think if they're a line cook, they're just kind of a cog in the wheel, but really they're obviously much more than that.
Oh no, the responsibility is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much that goes into putting out a great plate of food, building purveyor relationships, and learning about how the seasons cycle and what ingredients coming in when. You know, I know when asparagus and ramps are going to hit. So does every other chef in New York. But
sure,
these are things you have to go through learning, and then you put time into creating great food, and then you put it in the hands of, and then just to prepare for service, the prep, getting everything in. There's hours and hours of work that goes into putting a plate out. Right. And that last 10 seconds, what someone does, they could change what they do maybe 5%, and that'll have an exponential difference on how a guest enjoys that meal. And that's just something I try to, you know, really calmly and supportively let them know. You're not just a line cook. You're at a great point in your career with a big responsibility. So pay attention. And, you know, I let them know, I ask them, are you a Chevy or are you a Ferrari? Because when you're hitting that point, when you slow down, line cooking is, there's a lot of gross motor skills. Your arms are moving and you're turning meats and you're opening the oven and you're kicking it closed and you're turning around. But when it comes time to focus in on that 12-inch plate or whatever it is, what do? You just decompress that Ferrari engine and make it perfectly and make sure you hit the right amount of acid on those bit of greens? And for me, that's when I eat something that sends me there, that I think, wow, this is great. I can just imagine the care and attention that a cook put into it or that the chef put into it. And so that's what I try to impart onto them, is that's an important moment.
And when you're working with really young kids, I mean, when you hire for Union Square Cafe, who are you looking for? What are you looking for in a line cook?
I like to.
How do you?
I really
choose?
Put a lot into my time that I spend with them and the conversation I have with them. I mean, what do they say about certain foods? When I ask them, "What do you like to eat?" Do they jump right into something with their eyes wide and say, "You know, I love a big fatty burger." So that's mm-hmm. okay, you know. But
right.
What's the passion? What do they put out there? And I have to see how they work. How do they work from the elbow down? Are they fast that way? And do they look up when they start their trail? And someone says something, and service starts. Are they keyed into it? There's a lot of little things.
Can you teach it speed and quality?
I think the it that really good cooks have, it's hard to teach. You can teach them how to do your food, and you can, but there's a certain something you're looking for that you know someone's going to be great. Mm.
And are you able to like figure out like within a few weeks, you know, that somebody has a good palate, somebody has a bad palate, no palate. I mean, limited experience in restaurants, I mean, I was in the business for many years, but in my limited experience in restaurants, you know, I worked with, you know, a couple of chefs who literally had no palate. I mean, they had all the skills.
Right.
You know, CIA trained, knew what they were doing, great managers, you know, good at sourcing, all of that stuff. But the food was like totally boring and bland, and mm-hmm. there was nothing that made it sing in the way that, you know, chefs like you or, you know, I don't know, Michael Anthony or, you know, any of the other great right. chefs we've had in the studio here. They, you know, you guys have like, you have that, you know, something, there's a taste, you like, you know what you're going for.
Right.
So how do you identify that in the kids that come in, you know, they come out of culinary and then presumably they have like one or two jobs and then they come to you and say, "Hey, Carmen, I really groove on your vibe, man."
Well, you know, you just watch them and you watch them taste and you taste the food that they put up and you just evaluate as you go along. There's like a 2-week training process.
Uh-huh.
So let me ask, we'll get to the Union Square side of things in the next segment, which starts in 2 minutes. But I wanted to ask why you also worked at Validia mm-hmm. and in your bio, you wrote that it was intense. So that interests me because she was like, you could argue, the Alice Waters of Italian cuisine, Lydia Bastianich. Mm-hmm. And so why was it intense and what did you learn there?
I think when something's intense, it's a two-way street. It's the environment you're in and it's how important you think where you are is at. I mean, how did that come out? I don't know. It's what I thought about the food there. It's what I thought of. You know, when I was in California, I was there for a long time and it was the closest I could get to cooking in the Italian countryside without going to Italy.
Right, because of the terroir there.
Right, and when I came to New York, through trips to New York, somehow I'd ended up at Flitty a number of times. And Dodo, or Fortunato Nicotra, who's the chef there, cooked for us. And I thought, wow, this place feels like it's the closest place to Italian, that that touch that Italians have with their food without going to Italy. So somehow I thought, you know what, I'm just going to take a step back and become a line cook again for a few months. And I did that after for leaving you. California, and it was an amazing experience, and it gave me something I was looking for, and just that touch that, mm-hmm. that a chef like him has with Italian food.
Was that the first Italian, quote-unquote Italian restaurant you had worked for?
Yes, yes.
So and that I, was like the beginning of you really like reaching back into your own roots and I bringing that forward into what was happening at Felidia?
Yeah, I did a lot of that in Napa. You know, I became in touch with my
at
roots
Trevino,
in Napa.
Yeah, sure.
At Trevino. And I took a trip to Italy in my time there for about a month and a half. And so that had already started happening. But I just thought this was some place I could learn, and I did. And it was a very small kitchen. I think the other part of the intensity is that it was a tiny kitchen.
In Philadelphia?
And it was very busy all
at
once.
Well, that they really were the standard bearer for Italian cuisine for a
no
long
question.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we will come right back with Carmen Quagliata, and we will talk about Union Square Cafe and the culture that exists there.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
We're back at broadcasting from Roberta's. We have Carmen Quagliata in studio, the chef at Union Square Cafe for how many years, Carmen?
Oh, six now.
Six.
Yeah.
So I just got back from Iowa where I was visiting some of our farms. And it's funny, we visited four farms and each of those farms were in different towns. And I always ask the farm, does any restaurant within 300 miles of here serve your food? And they were like, no. Like, we cannot find all this great food that we raise, these purebred pigs and all that, are all shipped to the coasts.
Right.
So it was kind of interesting, just like accessibility of great ingredients. So I wanted to ask you, at Union Square, you know, which is right in the heart of the Green Market, obviously the biggest green market, you know, certainly in New York City, how do you afford all these great ingredients? And, you know, is that an issue? Like, sometimes having to meet food costs, mm-hmm. yet also hit, you know, what people expect when they come to a dinner at Union Square.
Well, I think you have to taste throughout the Green Market and look at prices. That's just the reality of it. You make a decision to say, we're going to buy on this level, and we're stuck with that. And then, not stuck with it, we're committed to that. Mm-hmm. And from there, you just make good decisions. And, you know, I think you have to look at your portions. Maybe they don't have to be as big. You just have to think wisely. But there's more work that goes into using ingredients like that.
Is there heavy competition for the best ingredients at Union Square? Do you just have to send some one of your guys there at like 2 a.m. to wait for a truck to come in?
There is heavy competition, actually, especially when it gets kind of lean. There's you'll see restaurants like Blue Hill or a couple of the other, you know, of course, Gramercy. We're all in the market by 8. Mm. And in October, November, when it starts to thin out, you definitely have to get on top of the stuff.
Ooh, that's interesting. Is there competition amongst your restaurants? Like, has there ever been like someone would go to?
It has happened. It happens.
Madison being like, dude, you can't go. That's my guy.
No, but there's I think Travis at Blue Hill, who I just met in the market. I don't know him well, but he I bought a bunch of stuff up one week, and I went back to the next week to the same farmer, and she said, "Oh, you know, I have to hold some back from Travis. He needed some of that last week," and I chuckled. And I know I've been there after he's been there sometimes, because I couldn't find a certain pepper at Norwich Meadows or, you know, one of our farmers. And a Modesto's tough from Gramercy. He's got a whole crew that goes down there with him, and and of course we are just across the street, so we can run in and out, and there's a lot of running across the street.
Man, I bet.
It's fun.
So how do you market sustainability at Union Square Cafe?
You know, we probably don't talk about it as much as we should, or put it on the menu, or have a statement at the bottom or anything, but our servers are fantastic, and they learn a lot about what we do in our food meetings before lunch and dinner, and they're really good at giving that to the guests.
So there's no expectation on the part of the guests. They're not asking you like, "Oh, did this come from Jack?" You know what I'm aiming at here. Did this come from such and such a farm? And, you know, did you get this locally, or, you know, how many miles has this traveled? And
yeah, there are people that do that, but I think a lot of people expect that that's the norm now. It's not it's not the exception.
Interesting.
Anymore. It's the rule.
So now you don't put farm names on your
We dishes? Do, and a lot of it is because I love the farmers or the people. You know, sometimes we don't put the farm. We'll just say like Rick's Rocket or. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever. It's more to pay homage to them than to feel like we need to say that.
So now, you know, of course, we want to ask a little bit about, you know, the whole Danny Meyer tradition. And, you know, I know there's a very defined culture to that to his restaurant group and to the restaurants. We've had Mike Anthony on most recently.
Right.
And, you know, he was telling us a little bit about it. So, you know, how do you navigate that culture, you know, find authorship within it, you know, be creative within it, take risks, but still stay true, you know, all that?
Well, at first you have to believe in it, and then the authorship for you to take is yours. I mean, Danny firmly believes on the chef and the GM running the restaurant, and you know, we absolutely believe in everything that he talks about. It's why we work with him, and I've been there for 6 years.
So how does he come in, like once a week, once a month, once a day, and then does he come to a staff meeting? Like what's
how
his
often does he taste your food?
Danny
tastes our food a lot. He actually, he's funny. I said something the other day. I said, it eats great. I'll talk about how a dish eats. And he chuckled and was teasing me a little bit. He said, instead of, did you eat it or it? You know, it's just funny. So he really does think a lot about our food and comments on it. And it's, you know, most often great. And he has an amazing palate and he's a visionary. So, and he has his thumb on the pulse of a lot going on in New York. So he'll give he'll say, "Did you know I had something like this somewhere else and they did this?" And you get a lot of different perspective, and you would never think of getting that from a CEO of a company that big. But, you know, he loves to eat. He loves to cook. And he comes in every once in a while because it's close by. He can say hello to some old friends and regulars. Mm-hmm. He has a lot that still come to Union Square.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's his flagship. So.
Right.
Yeah, and now
sure
does,
he has a special relationship.
Does he consider it an Italian restaurant? And do you consider it an Italian restaurant?
No, we've always considered it an American restaurant that cooks seasonally, locally, with an Italian soul. And I think that's why I fit in well there.
I have to say, I love the soul there. You know, I do sense that. Of all
actually,
his
Patrick
restaurants,
described the food as soulful this
morning. Of all
morning.
The restaurants in Danny Meyer's empire, I've always thought, because, you know, I lived in Italy for a while, and I've always enjoyed. And one time, I have to say, we were talking about the Sam Edwards. I was traveling with him through Iowa, and he was like, "Who do you have on tomorrow?" And I was like, "Carmen, you know, Carmen from Union Square." And we remembered this amazing dinner that Carmen cooked for us, where we brought him, I think, a 9-pound boneless Suriano, you know, prosciutto-style ham. And Carmen weaved in that prosciutto into courses.
Oh, nice.
And I always was impressed that at a place that's so, you know,
so busy.
Yeah, and also just you think so, you know, focused you know, that there could be that kind of Italian style of just being like, "I'm going to put a little of that."
Well, and the creativity involved in like figuring out how to immediately adapt your recipes and include that ingredient and show it to its best advantage. And
it's a great meal.
It's very impressive. You guys, let's talk a little bit, since we're talking about sustainability and everything. This morning when I was you know, getting ready for the show, I subscribe to all these meat newsletters because I'm a meat geek. And so this was on Drover's Network, and it was a really interesting article about a United Nations report that was put together by a Belgian legal, academic, and human rights expert. His name is Deschuter. And it's he's the
read the quote
special rapporteur to the right to food. Okay, so he told the Wall Street Journal that promoting natural farming techniques is the only sustainable way to guard against future food crisis. So his comments raised some eyebrows among many who believe the world's growing population cannot be fed without the use of available technology.
That mainly the Bill Gates Foundation was like...
But it's not just Bill Gates. I mean, obviously, it's the people who are actually running the major factory farms in our country and around the world. I mean, it's the Smithfields, the Tysons, the Cargills. I mean, all those guys, they're firmly ensconced in the, you know, in the mega agricultural thing. So this was a very sort of radical report. But what was interesting to me about it was that Bill Gates, you know, who we think of as this major philanthropist, and indeed he has just committed $1.4 billion, that's billion dollars, into agricultural development in Africa and South Asia, which is where big food deserts are going to happen, largely because of global warming, but also for other reasons.
Katie, you only have 5 more minutes for this.
I know,
question.
I know. I'm sorry. I know I'm the worst. Patrick has
it's
been
heavy.
Really, but he says, but they, I know this is a big issue. He says environmentalists are standing in the way of feeding humanity through their opposition to biotechnology, farm chemicals, and nitrogen fertilizer. And then he says, he goes on to say, it's a false choice, and it's he argues that the ideological wedge between groups who disregard environmental concerns and groups who discount productivity gains could thwart major breakthroughs that are within reach. It's a false choice, and it's dangerous for the field. It blocks important advances. It breeds hostility among people who need to work together, and if it makes it hard to launch a progressive and comprehensive program to help for farmers. Fact is, we need both productivity and sustainability. So how do you go? How do you, I mean, actually, we're joined in the studio by George Weld, who runs Egg and has a farm that is the source for Egg. How do you guys come down on that issue of like the sort of, maybe not the factory farm, but the, you know,
maybe
sort of more
GMO
commercial.
Food is not bad.
Yeah.
You know,
it feeds
something like
the world.
That.
It's, it, like I said, it feels so heavy.
But, it is. It's a huge, I mean, we are at the tipping point, in my opinion, on this.
I feel that everyone has a responsibility to do something that addresses that issue. Mm-hmm. And when that hostility starts to happen, or when Bill Gates thinks he needs to make a quote like that, it makes me feel like people think it all has to happen now in this generation, and it probably won't. And if I could, you know, I've had to say to some purveyor who told me a piece of meat's name and that it was raised on this, and I said, you know, I can't afford that. My price point, I have to make certain decisions, mm-hmm. but I am going to buy another product that's maybe not organic, but it's all natural. But I know I'm doing the best I can do now, and I'm telling my cooks about it, and the sous chefs know about it, and they know that we buy meat from you, Patrick, and they know the importance of everything we do, and then the cooks know about it, and I'm going to teach my kids about it, and I'm going to be dead before the big thing turns, before we're all sustainable and the planet is saved and we're going to be here another 20 million years. But at least I did my part now. I don't mm-hmm. think we can get hung up in feeling like it's...
What do you think the compromise is going to be between commercial farming techniques and local sustainable?
And also, that brings up your restaurant, Union Square Cafe, like it's elitist. I mean, there's also that elitist kind of
thing.
Well,
you're at a price point where you can afford to buy some of these products.
And, but you know
maybe
what?
Not all of them.
Not all of them. And some of our other restaurants, which are most of them are fine dining restaurants. I don't know if I would say Milano feels like Gramercy or EMP, but they can charge a lot more. And so... they can cover some of those costs a little bit
exactly.
better.
Like 11 Madison.
Right.
Restaurants like that.
But we're still going to go. We still use a lot of the same purveyors. And we just have to figure out how we make it work best for us. Nothing goes in the garbage. We use everything. And I don't know if I'm getting off the topic. But,
right on target.
Is your menu 100% where if money wasn't an issue, I mean, do you have to make compromises and sometimes buy a commodity, even at a high echelon restaurant like Union Square Cafe?
Yes, you know, we just can't afford domestic lamb on every part of the menu. You know, mm-hmm. we use whole lamb from Vermont, probably, and goat, and veal shoulder, I'm trying to think now. But for lamb chops, we use Australian lamb. Mm-hmm. And we just couldn't go to domestic lamb for the
Is there
lamb
a big
chops.
Emphasis in your menu on using the off cuts or what they call the value cuts?
And would that be accepted by your clientele?
Oh, yeah. definitely.
Because, I mean, you're talking about, you know, veal shoulder. I mean, I think most people don't think of veal shoulder as a particularly premium, although a rolled shoulder makes a great roast, right?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the last couple of weeks we've made a Blanquette de Veau just because I was feeling kind of French. And
and it's spring, and it's totally spring, appropriate.
Right. And who doesn't like a good stew?
Yeah.
And it's another issue. It's another topic to bring up into the kitchen. You know, cooks need to keep learning. They need to keep feeling that they're getting information. So that's another reason why.
And do you find that braising dishes are gaining popularity on restaurant menus? Because, I mean, those do deploy those value cuts as opposed to the middle meats. And that, I know, in the cattle industry has been a really big push on the part of, like, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the American Meat Institute. They really have been trying to educate chefs about using different parts of the cow and breaking it down in different ways. So how much are you able to sell that through to your customers, and how much are you able to change up your techniques from what people are used to?
Oh, it's easy. I've never felt like there was anything to catch up to.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, I want to ask one last question before we cut to a break and then bring George on. And that's awesome. You're going to stay, and then we'll bring everyone in afterwards. We also have, we forgot to mention who's on the show. We also have Brooklyn Slate Company, which is kind of cool. I love
local
Slate
business. And I love my Slate. I just met them.
Oh, yeah? Last month. They ate at the
beautiful
restaurant.
Yeah, here. Very beautiful, nice people. Things. Yeah.
So what can people find on the menu and tell us specials and all that? Like, what goes on at Union Square now? Spring is here. And, like, you know, what can people come to Union Square maybe that they wouldn't be expecting to find if they've been there many times?
You know, I guess it's my California days, but I love artichokes. I know they're not local here till June, I guess. Can't remember. But and they're not really, when they are local, it's not like all the beans and everything else from the farms around here. But I really dig artichokes. And
me too. It's one of my favorite foods.
It's the time of year that they're pretty plentiful and at a good price.
Do you do that fantastic Roman artichoke a la Judea? You know,
when
deep
we have
fried
baby ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh. And how come no one does chicken cordon bleu? Like chicken breast with artisan blue cheese in it.
No, that would be cool. That would be a nice twist.
Everyone loves that.
We're also doing a lot of cool things with, like, the meats I mentioned. We're going to be doing goats are back out there, so they're going to be.
That's very good news for Heritage Foods USA.
And, Katie is leading a goat project.
Oh, really?
Which means, by the way, I found all these goat farms out there. All the dairy, all the goat cheeses that are produced on mass scale are. You know,
are
that
out
milk
there.
Comes
the milk
from
comes from those
people.
Farms.
Even the Wisconsin, you know, goat farms.
Beauty.
They're in. I mean, the Wisconsin goat cheese. A lot of those farms.
Those farms
are
in
Iowa,
Iowa,
and all that, which is very north. I'm very surprised to see Iowa's almost like saying Ohio or something like that. I mean, it's really on that northeast side of the Midwest. You know what I mean? It's 4 hours from Chicago.
Yeah, right.
I didn't know that. You know, Decorah, Iowa is a great city. Anyway, so yeah, we're going to be trying to move goats because every dairy, the second they have a male goat born, they're like, if they're not going to keep it aside as a breeder, they're like, you know, we're not going to get paid a fair price for this because dairies, you know, aren't in the business of selling meat. So we're trying to help some goat farms. So don't worry, Carmen. This isn't a sale. You
know, I know
commit.
We'll get to the sale next week.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I can't say no to you.
He can't
how much
stop.
I love you, Patrick.
Carmen committed to half cow, which is no small feat. That's, you know, 400 pounds.
That's a big deal. Because last week, Patrick, we were talking about buying whole animals and the commitment that requires from a restaurant kitchen in terms of, you know, just the time and expertise involved in butchering a large animal like that and figuring out how you are going to use all of those different pieces and how much ground meat can you really move.
I just can't wait to see the look on my butcher's face.
Yeah, I know. When he's like, are you going to tell him?
Yeah, I'm going to film it too.
Okay,
I'm going to film
good.
The whole breakdown of it and
That's
get
awesome.
Everybody involved. It'll be a fun project.
Yeah.
Well, Carmen's going to stay on. We're going to take a break and come back with another guy who I've known for a few years. He's been supporting us, George Weld. And
from Egg.
Egg Restaurant, breakfast joint, amongst other things, here in Williamsburg. So thanks
Stay
for being
tuned.
On, Carmen, and we'll be
You're
right
welcome.
Back.
When I rode into town, down from the mine to lay some money down, stopped at a tavern they called Sweet Princess. There I met the girl in the red satin dress. Her gown shimmered scarlet as she walked. Across the room, I could see her soft skin and smell her sweet perfume. Her eyes flashed with lightning, she beckoned with a glance. My life might be in danger.
Welcome back to the main course. This is Heritage Radio Network broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime, Patrick Martins. Our guests today have been Carmen Qualiata from Union Square Cafe, and now we are joined in the studio by George Weld, who is the visionary behind Egg, a really, really popular restaurant in Brooklyn. And George, you have segued into a whole different trajectory, haven't you?
It doesn't feel different. We've just sort of grown from what we started out, kind of the idea behind Egg originally. Well, even before the restaurant started, we always thought, or I always thought, what I really wanted to do was have a little farm and supply restaurants with stuff. So the restaurant happened almost by accident. And,
well, you started out as doing a breakfast business in the location of another restaurant.
Right.
So you would
switch. That's crazy. What's the fascination with eggs with you?
That's such an interesting
you love eggs.
Model.
It's a breakfast. I mean, it's an interesting concept to start with breakfast and start in another spot.
My friends of mine gave me the opportunity to do it. I've always been a morning person, and I've always loved breakfast. And breakfast is sort of an easy thing for a Southerner to wrap his heart around. It just sort of all as I say, the restaurant happened almost by accident. And it kind of a lot of nice things came together simultaneously.
Well, you didn't come from a culinary background particularly, did
no,
you?
No, I'd worked in a lot of really bad restaurants growing up.
In the South, you're from Virginia or South Carolina?
Both.
Okay.
I kind of went back and forth from Virginia to North Carolina to South Carolina.
And you just grew up working in different restaurants down there?
Yeah, or? The best restaurant I ever worked in was the first one, where I was a busboy and a dishwasher and on this like really rural island we grew up on outside of Charleston.
Is that not Ossabaw Island, is it?
No. It's right next to Charleston. Now it's kind of a golf destination. But when I was there, it was pretty rural and pretty depressed. And this guy came out, I don't even know where he came from, but he came down and opened this restaurant in a really dumpy building that had been the home to one after another failed restaurant for as long as we'd lived there. And he was kind of an amazing person because he was an outsider, he was gay, he had a rat tail and an earring, and he was like a classically trained chef, and he showed up and started cooking right after this big Hurricane Hugo down there had wiped out everything. And
I remember
so
Hugo.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And
huge.
It was like one of the things he did was basically feed hundreds of construction workers who were there to rebuild the area. And it was an amazing thing to watch this guy who, in a very closed culture, was able to make connections with tons and tons of people that he wouldn't have access to in any other way, succeed. And, I was washing dishes and cutting out of work and not showing up for shifts and stuff like that. But still, in spite of all that, finding myself really inspired by his example. And
you were still just a busboy, so you had the lowliest job there, but yet it still inspired you.
Yeah, it was amazing to see. It was inspiring in two ways. One was his example, and one was sort of the watching people. I mean, he kind of did everything. He would ring people up in between cooking their food, and but he had a couple servers, and I remember watching these, adults really at the mercy of people who were, in some cases, kind of abusive. I mean, it was a very
sounds like a rough and tumble crowd.
Yeah, kind of it was the kind of place where you'd bring out a plate of really nicely composed stuff, and they would just mix it all up with their fork and knife and make a big mash out of it and shovel it down and leave 50 cents for a tip. And these were people who
Carmen
were like,
is like practically in tears.
You don't do that over there. Oh.
He cooked in West Virginia, so he might have seen that a couple
not
times.
At the Greenbrier,
a couple diners like that down there.
Yeah. This guy had come from the Greenbrier, the guy who ran this restaurant. And sort of seeing them kind of living this desperate life, basically trying to support their families and on tips made me think like, if I ever find myself in the position of, having a restaurant, I want to make sure that the people who work there, get to have decent lives. So it was inspiring as a counterexample also in that regard. Mm-hmm.
So then you worked in places like this, and then did you come to New York because you wanted to start a farm in upstate New York, or did you just come for other reasons, or because you wanted to cook?
I came up here to write a dissertation.
Oh, really? For a graduate school?
Yeah, I was in grad school in Virginia. We were living on... My family has a farm down there. And I was living there and in grad school, and I'd finished all my coursework and thought I'd come up here and do my dissertation.
On what? What was your major?
English Lit, American Lit. So.
So what was your subject?
Modernist poetry and visual text.
Sorry, Katie. It wasn't food journalism. Sorry, Katie.
That is great.
Nobody even talked about it then. It was the sort of thing that I was like, wow, yeah, someday.
Modernist poetry. Now
everyone talks about food in English departments. Because one of the things that's frustrating about that whole field is like you spend all this effort working on stuff that, you know, like I knew my mother would never even read my dissertation, much less anyone else I admired. Meanwhile, if I cooked people dinner, everybody was excited, and it was like, you know, it's a great way to connect to people. And so anyway, I moved up here and kind of fumbled around, and it was a kind of thing like, you know, I think once you work in the restaurant business, it sort of sits in you and waits to come back out.
It's true. You can never get away from it.
Yeah. And
it's like a slow braise.
Yeah.
It just sits there.
It's like The Godfather 3, as I recently learned, where Al Pacino's, I tried to get away, but it kept pulling me back. I feel
exactly.
The same way.
So then you were like, okay, academics is always going to remain, you know, for a select few, but cooking. So how did you start that? Where was your first gig here in New York?
It was Opening Egg.
Really?
Yeah,
so
man.
You were friends with these guys and you were like, you're closed during the morning. Could I open it during the morning?
Yeah, because we should explain that Egg opened in the premises of Sparky's, which was a hot dog and hamburger joint in Brooklyn.
And what's the address? It's on
North Fifth Street.
North
between
Fifth.
Barry and Bedford.
But then did you open a separate location?
No, they we tried to keep the two places going for a while, and then they opened up a couple other locations and wanted to focus
East
on them.
East Village. And,
and they opened one up in Massachusetts. And
So then it was yours.
Yeah, so they sort of sold it to me. And
and so do you do breakfast all day long?
We serve breakfast until 6. We do dinner after that. We also have a full lunch menu. So we serve a ton of different food out of there. It probably more than is
reasonable. All food with a Southern inflection?
The breakfast is definitely strongly Southern. I think
grits.
Farther as the day goes on, the food becomes less distinctly Southern, although there's always a...
So we have a question, because this Williamsburg is distinctly, you know, for lack of a better word, hipster. So Jack is going to play a little piece of one of this great comedian, Fred Armisen, and I want you to react to it and tell us how you...
Yeah, both of you, actually.
Both of you, yeah, and how you have to deal with this issue. Jack, do you have that thing?
Hi, hello.
My name is Dana. I'll be taking care of you today. If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local.
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local.
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
She's nice.
We're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I? I am so weird with that gas pedal. The thing just moves the whole vehicle forward now.
All right, so here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great. He looks like a happy little guy who runs around. A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like... You know, palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And you have a good relationship with this farm?
We do.
It's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami who's
goodness,
just
no.
saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being. The idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type. No.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we're gonna go check it out if you don't mind. Just if you could hold our seats.
Oh, now, now.
Yeah. We'll, I will be right back. We'll just want to make sure.
Just clean out. Okay. Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
So.
that's funny.
Oh, man. That was
that's from
fabulous.
Fred Armisen, and I don't know her name in Portlandia. Thanks, Jack. So do you encounter
yeah,
that?
Yeah, George, we want to know. Do you get
we
that?
We all watched that clip like 10 times right after it came out. I'm sure you guys did too. Yeah. And like almost minutes after watching it one day, two people came in up to the counter and ordered a duck. They were about to order a duck sandwich. And they said, what is Coleman's mustard? And like, oh, it's a British mustard. It's like a traditional British mustard. Huh. I mean, meanwhile, there's duck on this dish. There's like bread wrapping around it. You know, they're all...
But they focus on the mustard.
Is it organic? I was like, no, I don't think it's organic.
Which has been around for like 150 years. Like, years.
We buy the mustard powder and prepare it ourselves. You know, we use organic eggs and whatever else. Mm-hmm. It goes, but there's no weird like radiation in it. Or, no, I don't think so. Like, you know, it's
mostly, oh, George, how do you guys keep a straight face?
Yeah,
when
I mean,
happens?
Do you get that there you know, with you too?
We get a lot of that with fish. People uh-huh. really like to know. If it's wild or, you know, we use...
But actually, I think that's a really excellent trend because I was just reading something today
about... false labeling when it comes to
about
fish.
The false labeling. Yeah. And some guy, some chef, I think it was in D.C., went to jail. No, he's not doing... Yeah. He's going to jail. He's paying a $350,000 fine.
For what?
And lying for about false fish? Labeling his fish.
On the menu?
Yes.
Wow.
Ooh.
Yeah, this was jail? On Sean and Michael Dimon's on Seed to Table's website.
Oh, yeah, I saw that this morning.
You know, it's... I think comedy is always a good way to...
Point. Shoot to the heart.
Yeah, yeah, like it's okay that's pretty funny, but still it's an important issue and it isn't that's overdone, yes, but it's funny and it keeps your attention in that direction.
Yeah.
So have you had to deal with that, especially, I mean, I don't want to typecast Williamsburg people, but you know, they're like, oh, we're going to go eat an egg, which I know really well, so I want to ask all these questions. I mean, is it a difficult crowd or?
No, I mean, it's not the way you'd think. I mean, people come in pretty, we, you know, like Carmen, we don't make a big deal out of it. We don't raise people's expectations too much ourselves. And people are pretty laid back about that kind of stuff. They're excited about it. They're there because they want to, be involved in a place that promotes it. But,
promote it like on the menu. You won't say where the duck is from, or will your servers? I mean,
they all know what to say if somebody asks. We have a huge binder full of stuff that explains where everything comes from. That occasionally customers will ask to see, but you know, not like the Portlandia situation. But you know, I mean, I think our main, you know, we're there to serve people and. We respond to that when we have to, because people want to know about it. But we don't think of ourselves as much as in a educational role in the sense of like being didactic and explaining to people where, you know, what they should be eating. Mm-hmm. We just sort of take for granted that, you know, I mean, we do it for our own level of comfort, mm-hmm. I guess. So, it makes people, I think it puts people at ease. They don't feel like they're part of a big song and dance. It's just you're coming here to eat, and it happens to be that the food is well sourced.
It's really interesting breakfast now. I mean, how do you take risks and push, or is it about perfecting old standards? Like, what do you ask of your chefs, and you know, how do you push an envelope when it comes to hash browns or eggs or things like that?
We don't feel a whole lot of need to do it. We'll do it. Sort of for fun. I mean, the primary thing that people, when they come in to cook an egg, they have to learn how to do things the right way. And doing, you know, rolling an omelet correctly can take people weeks to figure out how to do. And so you don't need to learn a lot of new stuff. You need to figure out how to do the stuff you're supposed to do in the first place well.
And it sounds like the recipe there is get the best ingredients and don't screw it up.
That's definitely for breakfast our goal, yeah.
What's the challenge in rolling an omelet? I'm sure there is one, but I mean, like, what is the art? How would you define achieving a perfect roll, and why does it take people some weeks?
I mean, I think people don't take it seriously enough. People think, like, oh, I've scrambled these eggs long enough, they're well enough homogenized, and then they roll the almond out, and it's got, like, big white streaks in it, or the pan's the right temperature. if the pan's not the right temperature, it'll blister or bubble, and you want it to have a nice, smooth outer skin, and... Keep it really tender.
And not be brown.
I love your artisan omelet talk. That's great. I love it.
Yeah.
it's literally like the most mind-blowing difference of all the things that we serve on the menu when you compare a well-prepared one to a conventional one. I remember when someone taught me how to do it, and I watched him do it, I'm like, that's ridiculous. I can make a perfectly good omelet. And I took a bite of it, and I was like, oh, it's like a whole other kind of food. Mm. It's like eating, you know...
It's McDonald's
more like a rolled souffle
to
as opposed to a... Because it should be fluffy and tender.
The tender, right.
The tender is... like ours.
I mean, the thing that people get when they go to diners is not at all... It's like a with the brown exterior and it's tough. It has a skin you can scrape off, basically.
It should be a pizza, you know? Like, that's what they should order. Because that's what... Or, it's all about the toppings, whatever.
Yeah.
And what eggs do you use? And what is a good egg and what's a bad egg? And, you know, because I suppose there's also an art to that raw ingredient.
Well, we get our eggs from Knollcrest.
Okay. Oh, yes.
Our dairy provider, Ronnie Brook, has a relationship with them, and they actually bring the eggs down for us.
Are they white or brown? Or
They're brown. And I mean, one of the interesting things about working with Ronnie Brook and with Knollcrest, and one of the things that we're able to do since, you know, we started from this position is, you know, they change during the year. I mean, the milk changes during the year, the eggs change during the year. Sometimes they're really frustrating. The eggs, the shells are really thin, and they, like, you pick them up and they fall apart in your hand.
Really?
But
I thought you were supposed to be able to... Well,
there's some weird physics trick you can do with them.
It's kind of cool.
But, you know, when you're picking them up with three fingers, sometimes your thumb just goes right into it. And, so you kind of have to adjust on the fly as these changes happen. So I think, I don't know, that's kind of our position has always been to say, like, we want to have a relationship with these people. We want to support what they're doing. And we'll figure out how to, you know, if we have to tweak what we do to allow us to do that, or that's fine. You know, that's part of, you know, I come from a, you know, my mentality has been like, this is how people ate a long time, you know, 50 years ago, everyone had to eat like this. Like, you got what you got and you dealt with it. And that's kind of how we try to work. Mm.
So the standardized, I mean, what has characterized industrial agriculture over the last probably 50 years has been trying to achieve a perfect consistency to product. I mean, when beef is graded, you know, it's like they want exactly the same size eye. They want exactly the same thickness on the fat cap. They want exactly the same amount of marbling. And it's the same thing with, you know, how the egg is, you know, with the size of it or whatever. And all of the same thing with chicken. I mean, everybody's genetics become homogenized and brought down to one particular standard. And I think that what you're saying is the new, you know, the new paradigm is to work with the way the animals actually work. Instead of forcing them into our mold, we, you know, are moving forward into accepting what the differences within each breed or within each.
And plus, it's hard to return product when it's like a tiny, I mean, Ronnie Brook is very successful, but, you know, you're like, no, send these eggs back, you know, all of a sudden they're like, what do we do with it?
You so
know,
now, so George, you went, but what's interesting about your story is that you went from working in the restaurant to now you have a farm that supplies your restaurant.
Yeah, some.
So how did that happen? Let's hear that story.
He's gone from a member of the congregation to minister.
That's right.
Just like his father.
Hallelujah.
Never escaped. It sort of was a... my wife wanted to move out of the city like almost immediately after we moved here.
Is she also from the South?
Yeah, she grew up in Tennessee. And we compromised here and there, and, you know, moving. We used to live on the Lower East Side, and we moved to Williamsburg. It was like moving to the suburbs. You know, it was like one little thing after another. And at some point, it was like the city was wearing on her. And
was she in the industry as well?
No. She works. She actually works for Nickelodeon.
Okay.
So we started thinking about, like, oh, maybe instead of going back to Virginia, we can find something close by, or we can get out. And at any rate, it became this moment came where her desire to get out of town and my desire to sort of get my hands in the dirt and start doing stuff for the restaurant coincided, and we could agree, like, all right, well, if we buy a place upstate, then, you know, we can go up for work, we can go up for to chill out or whatever. And so that's kind of what we did. We found a spot in Greene County.
Where is that?
We're on the in between Albany and the ski mountains in the Catskills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're not about half an hour west of Hudson.
So are you near like Oneonta or near Tannersville, Hunter Mountain?
We're close. We're about 45 minutes from those places, about 15 minutes
Saugerties.
From... fairly close to Saugerties, a little farther north from those places. Uh-huh. The ski mountain we're close to is Windham. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's great.
Really and, spectacular and gorgeous agricultural land.
How many acres do you have and what do you raise there?
We have 6 acres. We have about this year we'll have about 1.5 acres under cultivation for just whatever vegetables we can get going. We don't know a whole lot about what we're doing. We have one woman who used to be a server at the restaurant who lives up there full time now. And she's kind of learning on the job, and she spent all last summer up there, like, and produced tons and tons and tons of vegetables out of a very small plot.
What did you raise? What were your needs? I mean, you were raising mainly for egg, right?
We raised almost, we ended up selling a little bit to other people, but almost everything that we grew came to egg.
So what did you need at egg, and what could you grow up there?
We grew tons of kale, which we serve a lot of. We grew tons of salad greens, which we serve a lot of, and then... You know, we grew a lot of tomatoes. We grew a lot of beans and peas. We grew a few potatoes. You know, we kind of had the same attitude as we have towards everything else. Like, we'll see what we can grow and figure out what to do with it when we get it. So that what we're doing this year is just trying to plant as much stuff as we can and figure out a way to work it all into our menu. We leave a lot of space in our menu for working in kind of whatever random thing we can get our hands on. So it was less about responding to need than it was about pursuing a kind of pleasure and interest.
Philosophical and
more visceral than that, but yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, let's take a 1 minute break and we will come back with George Weld
and Carmen Quagliata
in studio.
Her eyes flashed with lightning, she beckoned with a glance. My life might be in danger, I thought I'd take a chance. Hair black as a raven and eyes full of fire. Voice up there's a whisper, filled me with desire. Captured by her charm, like a man possessed. Top of the stairs, I could smell her perfume, I knew she was there. But when I stepped inside, I faced another man. She came from behind, my knife was in her hand. I don't know what happened, my head was spinning round. I heard a soft voice whisper and stumbled to the ground. I saw a man lying, my knife deep in his chest. And gone was the girl in the red satin dress. Mercy, but can't find a trace. They don't believe my story. Time's run out, I guess. No one's seen a girl in a red satin dress.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network, and I am your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime, Patrick Martins. We're in the studio today with George Weld of Egg Restaurant in Brooklyn, and Carmen Quagliata from Union Square Cafe. Thanks again, you guys, for coming into the studio today.
Well, I have a question that relates to both. You're about to go on a long vacation, and yes. you have left, essentially, your wet restaurant to go work on the farm. So talk about delegation and the art of management and, you know, how to keep a certain level going even when you're not there.
Well, I think first you have to let them know that it's also their restaurant to succeed in and to grow in. And you have to hold them accountable as they're learning throughout. You know, you just don't... You have to get to a point where you feel comfortable going away, I guess. You could say the same thing, right, George?
Yeah.
And that's the longer, more important process, is that you're training them, you're teaching them, you're mentoring them, and then through the mistakes, they're accountable for those mistakes.
Have there been certain eras within your reign as the chef at Union Square, you're just like, I'm not going anywhere. This team is not ready yet. I mean, I imagine like when a team leaves and...
Yeah, it's when there's turnover.
Yeah.
You know, you have... Because cooks and sous chefs are supposed to follow their dreams. And when that happens, those are the times that...
Like the gentleman who's now at Teapol?
At Teapol, TJ. Yeah.
Yeah, TJ is doing well there, huh?
TJ was the force behind the turkey pot pie.
That we use,
that we use your heritage turkeys every year.
Fantastic.
20 turkeys a year. And then I'm never sure. I'm like, are they still going to do that pot pie? And they're like, then some guy who picks up the phone is like, we'll take 20. I'm like, all right.
Gotta love that.
I hope you're sure.
I love Tia Pole, too.
Yeah.
So tell us about that egg. I mean, what was it like, you know, being involved from the beginning and then just being like, now I'm going to go, you know, to the source?
It was pretty painful because I was completely inept at it.
Inept at what? Leaving?
Managing.
At management.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, it was my approach to it from the get-go had been like, well, I'm just here all the time. I'm doing everything. I wasn't that great at that either, but at least I was there. And like, and I was the only person who had to take the fall if things went wrong. I hired, the best I could, but I didn't even really know what I was looking for. I got really lucky in hiring a couple people who are still there. The woman who sort of runs operations for us now, Holly, is like, I just got really lucky with. And she started out waiting tables there, and she really has a passion for making things work. So she's been helping with that and kind of keeping me on track and helping me get to the point where I can pursue the things that I think we want to do as a company and know that everything's going to keep going well. Mm-hmm. More recently, I've been able to hire. We kind of tweaked our whole hiring mentality, and a lot of it came from studying kind of what you know, Danny Meyer has done and what goes on over at places like Carmen's, to try to say like, all right, well, how are we going to get great people in here? And, you know, we had always tried to hire really smart people, but especially in the cooking business, you can hire people who are really smart, but who are also a little nuts. So we've been trying to focus on finding people who are really smart and are also stable and interested in growing and becoming more like, you know, treating this like a job for, people who want to do it for a long time.
For a lifetime. You know, trying to, a career as opposed to something transient.
Tell us about the chef now.
Well, we got two guys kind of run the kitchen at Egg. One guy, Mike Porsche, has been there been there forever. He's coming up on his fifth year there. And he's sort of the rock of the breakfast team. And then more recently, we've hired a guy named Evan Hanser, who he worked at the dressing room in Connecticut for Michel Nichon for a long time. And then he worked at La Conda Verde for a little bit. You know, like everyone else there, has a really diverse background, interest in lots of different things, but is passionate about food and loves sort of the direction we're going in, and loves going up to the farm when he can to help out. So, you know, they're great, stable people. And we meet all the time and talk about stuff all the time. And,
I want to get more to the farm, but in terms of affording great ingredients, and I know you do other things, but in the breakfast context, like how far have you pushed the price that, you know, breakfast would go for, or lunch, or have you not pushed it at all? And how do you, we asked the same question to Carmen, you know, affording great ingredients while still, you know, hitting your bottom line.
Well, like I said, we sort of took it as a, like, without those ingredients, I didn't want to have a restaurant if I couldn't do that. So that was sort of the point we began with. Mm-hmm. What's driven our costs up has been trying to treat the people who work there better. you know, the as far as like meeting food costs, we're vigilant about tracking it, and but so we end up buying stuff that is versatile, or stuff that, you know, we buy half pigs, we buy like big pieces of meat when we can, we buy whole birds, and just try to figure out ways to make it work. Having lunch and dinner makes it a lot easier to do that.
Do you have a liquor license?
We sell beer and wine. Yeah.
Beer and wine, right?
But that wasn't the panacea we'd hoped it would be. So we keep a really like strict eye on our numbers. But you know, we can't budge on a lot of that stuff.
You got to, Katie, if she moves into the neighborhood, she's good for 4 or 5 beers at breakfast.
At least. So, oh, yeah, no problem, Katie. Man.
That would help a lot.
40s.
40s.
We can change our list. 40s.
Are you allowed to serve beer and wine at 10 a.m.? I've never had
one, but. Every day but Sunday.
Interesting.
Yeah, not when you're supposed to be at church.
Yeah, exactly. Then that's a no-no. Very, very interesting. So what has been the greatest challenge? I pose this to both of you. What is the greatest challenge of running a successful restaurant in New York City? Or what has been? I mean, what is currently, or what's been the greatest?
I think your competition. There's so many great, great cooks out there.
Yeah.
And you learn from them, and you also have to battle with them. And there's a lot of restaurants and a lot of very knowledgeable people. They know what they're eating. You know, most of all of our guests have eaten all over the city and been in Europe back and forth. And I would say that.
I was recently talking to Jeff McClure, who I hope to have as a guest on the show in a few weeks. And he is the director of the educational aspect, or the part of Sodexo that services universities and schools. And he said that in the last 5 years, the level of information that the children are coming into college with about food, about sustainability, about flavor profiles, about ethnic ingredients has just ratcheted up his, you know, world to a completely different level. And he actually now has a student board of governors that helps Sodexo identify and understand what the food trends are and what kids want to eat now. And that he really...
They always want the same thing.
They don't.
Food trends. They want burgers.
No.
And pizza. Yes.
No. I think they want Vietnamese. They want Korean. Really? Absolutely.
I mean, they might want it, but I guess. All right. Sorry.
No, they do. I mean, I thought,
you know,
it was really
that resonates with me because I actually spoke at Yale last year. No, I didn't speak. I was in a room with some students.
At the Yale Sustainable thing? The program
They took me through the gardens, and the students there, a lot of them were freshmen. I think they were all freshmen. They were unbelievable, their knowledge and their questions. Some of them were kind of went on that Portlandia skit edge a little, but I didn't expect it, and they were a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a new generation coming up that is going to be pushing this, you know, even further than sort of what we expect from the people who can normally afford to go to restaurants like Union Square Cafe.
And then they'll stuff what Bill Gates said.
Yeah.
All that
stuff. That's it's the demand for that is what's going to make it happen.
Yeah, you know? I think
if we
so
offer it, it'll be there for them.
And on the farm, I mean, like, did something just like blow your mind and you're like, oh my God, like, I didn't know it would be this complicated or this hard, or your kale didn't grow the first year.
Yeah, the weather.
Like, the weather.
The weather sucks. It's always the worst.
Oh, man.
But, no,
because there are a lot of young farms. I mean, people are going to start a farm. So, like, what advice would you give them? Lessons learned the hard way kind of thing.
Well, I mean, our whole arrangement is kind of weird because, unlike, I think one of the things that's really hard for most, farmers is finding a place to sell their produce, and we don't have to do that. We just we sort of set it up like a CSA, so that the restaurant pays the farm a fee year round that helps keep it going, and we get all the produce from it.
How do you get the product down?
Chrissy drives it down a lot. We send it back. We send it down on the Ronnie Brook trucks every now and then. Mm-hmm. I hope we're going to send some down on another truck. You know, there are a lot of people up there who are consolidating stuff from different farms and bringing stuff down. We're trying to get involved.
We should actually say the gentleman from that trucking company in New York State just passed away. Did you hear about that?
No, I did not.
No, it's No, the trucking service. I think maybe it was a bigger trucking service, you know, that would move pallets of things. Mm-hmm. But I mean, distribution
has been a key theme throughout the. I mean, in the 2 years that Patrick and I have been doing this show together, distribution and processing have been the two key themes that we come up against every, you know, with restaurateurs, with chefs, with producers, with everybody in the food business. It's like, how do you get this stuff from point A to point B in a way that doesn't make it prohibitively expensive? It's been
or
a very
just miserable for the people who do it. I mean, I think one of the
terrible.
Things that's really
it's criminal.
I live on North 6th Street and I pass by Burke Lombardo, which is like a meat processing place every day. And I was just saying to Evan yesterday, when I was starting out Egg and I was leaving my apartment every morning at 5 and walking down the street and thinking like, oh my God, I've been doing this every day for 130 days. I would pass these guys who are, you know, they're grandfathers now, and they're finishing their shift at the meatpacking place at 4:30, 5 in the morning. And it's like, well, at least I'm not doing that. And who's taking care of those people? You know, like, and when we buy stuff, like who's watching out for the, you know, I mean, the whole thing, it's just like, you can take care of the product on the farm. You can try to help farmers. Like they're faces that you can meet and recognize.
Sure.
But there's this whole, like, you know, chain in between there and your restaurant, where you can do the same thing. Where like you don't know what's going on. You don't know who those people are. You don't know how to help them if they need. You know, like mm-hmm. it's just like it's a scary, like.
Well, I think most consumers have a real gap between. You know, they think it's, I mean, to go back to that Portlandia skit, I mean, it's like, yeah, you know, it's the name of the bird is Colin and it was raised by, you know, Gail and Mary or whatever, you know, but then it's like, well, then what happened?
Right.
I mean, who killed it? Who eviscerated it?
Well, that's actually a big issue with Temple Grandin, who we just had on, thanks to Katie, a couple of weeks ago. And she actually gives this imprimatur of greatness to all these companies that might mistreat the animal. So, I mean, it works both ways because, you know, they kill very well, but then the rest of the time, a lot of those animals are in a feedlot. And yet they have Temple Grandin on the Smithfield website with the thumbs up. There's nothing wrong with that, too, although, thank God, she's doing what she's doing, you know?
Yeah, so absolutely. Well, you know, she's changing it one farm or one processing plant at a time, basically.
On this issue of, you know, complicated issues, which you brought up with the GMO, you were recently in a Time magazine article with my fiancé, Ann Saxelby, and it was about, is organic good, is organic bad? And you were one of a few people interviewed, Ann and Riyadh and Lee from, you know, Manette and Balthazar, so... where did you come out on that issue of is organic a better product?
That article is framed in kind of a weird way because they asked, when they were preparing us for it, they said sometimes we're doing a thing on local food, and then they said sometimes we're doing a thing on organic food. So in my case, it was easy because I brought a Knollcrest egg, which isn't certified organic, but it's treated the same way it would be. But it's local. I mean, I kind of fudged it. I kind of said, like, this is a good egg and this is a bad egg. This is easy to do. But in the case of some people who took the stuff they got, like, I know a couple people got, like, a carrot, an organic carrot from Mexico and a conventional carrot from Texas. And it's like, who, you know, the flavor difference in those two things, which is what the premise of the article was, the flavor difference there isn't necessarily going to be that dramatic. Same thing with a tomato in the article. In that article, I think they had one. The organic one wasn't local. It was a big organic thing.
Sure, organic has become big business. So
that's a roundabout way of saying like I. It was obvious to me. It was easy to see for me that it was you know the well raised egg. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was a fresher egg because it hadn't been sitting in a warehouse for a long time somewhere. Mm. I thought Anne had one of the best answers of anyone about the whole thing when she was talking about cheese, you know, saying, you know, that basically acknowledges a lot that goes into this, to the flavor, a lot goes into it, in addition to the sort of meeting this mark of, you know, being organic or not.
Oh, very interesting. Well, if one thing I've learned today is I want to start saying tomato.
You don't say tomato?
I say tomato, but I feel like
caught
an
that
idiot.
Too.
I say like tomato also.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's such a rare thing to
I'm from New England.
It is a tomato. I mean, the industrial one is a tomato. But if it's a great thing, it should be a tomato. I love it.
My mother said tomato.
I say tomato. Jack, can you get that online right now? It's a famous song. Who sang that originally?
I don't know, but
Billie
I know
Holiday or something.
Nothing that sexy, believe me.
Well, this is great. Do you guys have websites that people can go to? I mean, obviously, that you know, people, you guys are almost institutions. You know, Union Square has been around for so long, but I mean, where do people go to see about you know, menu changes and this and that?
UnionSquareCafe.com.
Very nice. And Egg?
Pigandegg.com.
Pig and egg. You couldn't get egg.com?
No, it was somehow it was taken.
Oh, who would have thought?
Imagine that.
We put a lot of stuff. We put our specials are always tweeted.
Yeah. Did you tweet your interview today?
I did.
Oh, nice. You know, it's funny. Good. I had to get a Gmail account, and I was trying to get Patrick Martin's, and I would have had to get Patrick Martin's 480. But if you put the number in front, did get one Patrick Martin's. So that was
and he is
cool.
One Patrick Martin's.
One.
Let me tell
thanks
you.
To you, Katie. I would have been a zero without you, a double zero.
Love you.
Well, we're gonna have a very interesting group, and there is something about the minimalist edition. That this adds to a kitchen, a piece of slate on which to work, just like a cutting board, you know. And so we're gonna have
Have the peeps back from Brooklyn Slate.
Hopefully they brought me a piece of slate.
You didn't get one at MoFed, huh?
I forgot my gift.
Many thanks to our guests today, George Weld from Egg and Carmen Qualiata from the Union Square Cafe. I hope you guys will join us again another time to debate the big issues around agriculture and sustainability. There's just no end to stuff to talk about.
Would love to.
Cool.
Something must be done.
You say either, I say either. You say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, and either, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. Yes, you like potato, and I like potato. You like tomato, I like tomato. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. But if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And if we ever part, then that might break my heart. So if you like pajamas, I like pajamas. I'll wear pajamas. Give up pajamas. For we know we need each other, so we better call it off. Oh, let's call the whole thing off. Yeah.
You say laughter and I say laughter. You say after and I say after. Laughter. Vanilla and I like vanilla. You sarsaparilla and I sarsaparilla. Vanilla, vanilla, or chocolate, strawberry. Let's call the whole thing off. But if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And if we ever part, then that might break my heart. So if you go for oysters and I go for oysters, I'll order oysters and cancel the oysters. For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling off. Let's call the whole thing off.
Yes, you say either.
And you say either.
You say neither.
And you say neither.
Either.
So here we are back on the main course for our final segment. We have Christy Hattica and Sean Tice from Brooklyn Slate. And there's a couple of connections. One, we met them at the Museum of Food and Drink fundraiser.
Where they very kindly donated a Brooklyn Slate for every gift bag.
That was the most awesome thing in that bag. And then
it was, no question about it. I mean, not that everything else wasn't cool too, but this was like substantial.
And there was there's a connection through Michael Harlan Turkle, who has a show called The Food Scene on the Heritage Radio Network. And it's really one of our best shows. So tell us about that connection real real quick before we get into Brooklyn Slate through Michael Harlan Turkle?
Well, we advertise an edible magazine. So we had reached out to him because we think he does such great photographs for them. And so we collaborated with him on our new lookbook, actually.
That's great. This your new lookbook nice is book. Beautiful, by the way.
Thank so you. Tell us about Slate. First of all, what is, I mean, Slate's a stone, obviously, but where is it grown? And, you know, why is it good for, I mean, where does it grow, I should say, and how is it harvested?
Well, we source our slate from my family's quarries in upstate New York and Vermont. There's a region called the Slate Valley, which is like 5 miles wide and 22 miles long. And we have two quarries there.
And are you guys at risk for hydrofracking?
I don't even know what that
is. Oh, really? Okay, never mind. We'll go on.
We're not at risk, no.
Okay, good. So your all-natural slate comes from your third-generation quarry. That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And what is a quarry? What defines a quarry? Is it just where stone exists and where it's taken out? Or?
The quarry is actually the hole that develops after you blast the stone out. And it eventually collects with water, and then they form lakes. And then that's
so, like, unlike a mine, you're not going into the ground. It just goes straight down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not making tunnels. You're exactly. just making right. a hole.
Is it a limited like supply? A is this company destined to end one day if you become very successful?
Maybe in like 200 years, oh, okay. but not in my lifetime.
But there's a lot of slate. Now, your slates, you very kindly brought us examples of them. They're look beautiful. Like they're about 6 inches wide by a foot long. Is that about
right?
Yeah,
those are 7x12.
7x12. And okay, that wasn't too far off. And what and people use them for presentation. It's really a beautiful product. It's gorgeous.
No, it's how do really they shape? Cool.
How do you get it out of the quarry in what size?
And who gets it? And using what machinery?
My father gets it. He uses he blasts it from the ground and then
using dynamite.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah,
he has a blasting license. Which cool. Sean thinks is about very the coolest
cool. Oh yeah, that's such a boy thing. Man.
I'm waiting to get mine.
Patrick is going to be going up there.
I'm
going to
ask all these questions, just so because it is so fascinating, and I know nothing about it. How does one get a dynamite blasting license?
I actually have no idea. I mean, I really don't know.
Yeah, I think you head to your state capitol, and you fill out some forms.
He had dynamite. Did he have explosive experience in the military or something?
No,
I would think that kind of stuff would be like militarily. Come
sort
from
of standard
that,
fare, sort of, yeah.
So he blasts it, and then what happens? A bunch of stone
yeah, how
falls
big is
off.
The piece that
there are
comes
huge
out?
Boulders, and then they
oh,
take
like several tons.
Huge bucket loaders, and they put them in these humongous dump trucks that look like they could drive on the moon, and they like bring it up to a yard, which is so they come up from the quarry, and then they.
Who owns these trucks? Is it him?
My father does.
He buys trucks to get this.
He had this. He had the quarry business going long before you decided to start marketing these.
Oh yeah, he thinks we're insane for what we do. He does like slate roofs and.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, these basically look like slate shingles to me.
Yeah, that's basically what they are.
So
yeah.
Now, where is slate in the hierarchy of like roofing? I mean, it's a very beautiful stone. Like in the kitchen, it's very dark gray. It looks very elegant. Like
it has a lovely
sort of
diagonal stripe to it. Very subtle stripe. Stripe to it. It's beautiful.
They make really great slate roofs.
I mean, they last up to 200 years. So yeah. It's sort of an investment if you're going to have a home and really want to have a solid roof. But in the 60s and 70s, synthetic tile came into existence. And so that kind of put slate on the back burner. And now I think people are kind of coming back to it as a natural
it's expensive,
alternative.
Though, that's,
yeah, it's more expensive.
It's expensive. And also,
tile.
You have to build an infrastructure right. that can support
right,
a
heavy.
Stone roof.
Mm-hmm. So he yeah, takes exactly. it up. I'm sorry different... to interrupt. He takes it up to the yard.
Right. And then it's split with pavement cleavers and then into more manageable pieces. And then they just start cutting it with saws. And then that.
Into what size pieces? If it's a roof, it's a massive, like, 2-ton piece?
No,
something?
No. It's shingles.
Oh,
it's exactly
shingles.
The same as shingles.
Got
yeah.
it.
And then they drill them and they nail them
yeah.
to the roof.
And
yeah.
you can nail through this? And it
yeah,
won't
you,
crack?
Can, you can drill it, yeah.
It won't crack?
No.
So, and then you guys started a kind of boutique business within this massive quarry.
And that's just because you saw how beautiful these pieces are and you thought, wow, that would make
yeah,
great
can,
presentation items.
Yeah, we had actually been repurposing pieces.
So uh-huh.
We started.
Now, that comes with a little, a little packet that has, four cork circles, which I take it are to not scratch the surface right. that you put the slate on.
Right.
Then there's also a little piece of what looks to be marble, a little rectangle. What's that for?
That's a soapstone pencil. So you can use that to identify cheeses or whatever else you plate on the slate.
Wow.
Wicked. And then cool, you guys.
You can just take it off with well,
you can
with
wipe it down,
finger.
Just comes off, yeah.
And beauty. What is it used for? Like, how do you tell people, like, why do they need slate? Because this is absolutely gorgeous, and I think all our listeners should absolutely get a few of these. Like, why do people need slate, or how is it helpful?
I think it's just, it's a beautiful presentation piece, and it's non-porous, so nothing will stain it. It's dishwasher safe.
Yeah, unlike wood, it won't sort of deteriorate over time, and it requires pretty low maintenance, so
now, is practical. It a cutting board?
No.
No.
You would wreck your knife instantly on this.
Really?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So is it a cooking device?
We're actually,
can you heat it up and then put an egg on it and cook it?
It's funny you say that. We're actually working on that right now. We're trying to... In France, that's actually fairly common. It's sort of like a heat plate, and then you can cook fish or anything else.
You know, I was wondering about using it as like a pizza stone, although, as you said, right. it's not porous, so you wouldn't put any water... You wouldn't soak it, for instance.
So these sandwiches, for instance, that you have in this book is a sandwich that's put onto it, you know, as a... It's like a tray.
Serving
yeah.
plate.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this is, what did you say this
That's
was?
Awesome.
A foot by 6 inches by a foot or something?
7 inches by 12 inches.
Now, how much does a piece of slate like this go for, and how can people buy it?
That is $24, and you can buy it on our website, or...
Which is brooklynslate.com.
That's yes. right, yeah.
Beauty.
And do you sell at Brooklyn Kitchen or any of these types mm-hmm. of places?
Yep, the Meat Hook, Brooklyn Larder, Stinky Brooklyn, a number of shops in Brooklyn and Manhattan.
Yeah, I would think all the cheese shops would want to stock this.
Well, Anne is going to be
so
stocking
attractive.
It, by the way, she said, yeah. not Saxon.
No, I think it's awesome.
Too,
I so. Love them. I was yeah. really pleased to get mine, and I'm really pleased to have a second.
And what's the greatest challenge to being an entrepreneur in slate? I mean, is it trying to explain to people that it's useful, or I mean, have people been quick to understand its value?
You definitely have to explain from time to time. For me, it's heavy, so you know, moving around on this sort of product is challenging. Yeah. But definitely, just you know, we've been growing very well, so we're scaling is a really big challenge, and trying to meet the expectations of getting the product out there, that's challenging.
So how many of these do you have to sell to be the equivalent of one roof that your dad, probably like hundreds?
I think 2,000 maybe.
Oh yeah. Man. Well, I think this is really, really beautiful. And you know, it's funny, these subtle little additions to a kitchen can really add a
no
tremendous
question about
style
it.
And gravitas.
Absolutely.
And
it's a great wedding gift, actually.
Perfect for weddings. Yeah. And Mother's Day is coming up.
Yeah.
Do you do it in different sizes? I mean, can someone commission a 5 foot by 3 foot piece?
Yeah, we do custom. We also sell 2 other sizes on the website. We make
coasters. Sort of standard retail sizes and coasters, and then we do custom cuts and engraving as well.
Engraving.
Just started doing that.
So it could say dedicated to what? Now, if this is such a tough thing to cut into, what tool can you use to engrave?
Sandblasting.
Really? That's yeah. what it takes.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's, you know, because of the surface, it's not exactly perfect. A laser can't cut into it as well as sand. Oh. So actually a rougher material is more effective.
So like a serrated type of
It's a sedimentary right. stone.
Exactly.
So it's many,
exactly.
many layers. I remember that from like 8th grade earth sciences.
Did
and
they
you
even...
Can see,
now, this
like,
is right when these
the
stones were being... Katie was
That's
right.
That's when I was in school.
Yeah, right,
right when these
stones
were being
were
formed.
Finally. Now, how yeah. old is this slate?
Hundreds of thousands of years old.
Oh, that's
hundreds
about
of
right.
thousands.
Extremely old.
Yeah, it's very old.
Just like me.
How common, how frequent is slate around the country? I mean, or around the world?
I think it's more frequent in the area where it comes from. And like I said, it's for slate roofs and stuff. It's more expensive, so.
But where is it grown? Where does it exist?
Primarily in northeastern
yeah,
United
in China
States
and South America.
And there's you can see there's variations too in the texture and feel from different
How
regions.
How about the color?
We can do black, red, and blue gray. I'm pretty wow. sure China only exports black.
What's yeah. this? Blue gray?
That's a strata gray.
Strata gray or black is what we call it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, this is awesome. I personally am going to be buying a couple more of these, so hopefully direct from you and not through Anne. No, just kidding. But this is great. So tell me the website one more time.
It's brooklynslate.com.
Brooklynslate.com. Mm-hmm. You can also go to the Brooklyn Kitchen, the Meat Hook, Brooklyn and Larder soon, on Flatbush Avenue. Saks will be cheesemongers. Well, thanks so much for coming on, and this will now be tagged forever, just like my kitchen will be tagged.
And you can link this to your
tagged.
Website.
So thanks so much for coming on, and this has been
and
a great
thanks
show.
Thanks to our sponsor, and thanks to our
Fairway
all of our
Market.
Guests.
Yeah, and we have some big guests coming up in the future, Eric Asimov, and it's going to be a good summer. So,
absolutely.
Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market. The following message is from the Barter House.
Well, I think part of the sourcing process to me is the most exciting, because you know, you rent a car and you drive through the south of France, and you know, you obviously have some appointments set up, but you know, some of the most exciting things happen when you're just kind of winging it. And you meet a farmer at, you know, a wine fair, and he's, you know, he says, "Well, come back to my estate," and you're not quite sure where you're going, and you follow a guy in a Peugeot, you know, up a rambling hill, and all of a sudden you come across either a castle or like a shack in the woods, and the guy's making wine out of the back of his, you know, house, or he could be making wine out of a major estate. You know, looks are deceiving, but you want to assume that someone with a very established chateau is making good wine. But 9 times out of 10, the guy out of the garage who's like super passionate is making these better wines, and they're maybe more rustic and less polished. So to me, like the restaurateur, the sommelier, this story resonates with them about the small farmer, you know, the guy who's making wine on small quantities, 80 cases, 100 cases. Those are the things exciting to Barter House, and hopefully the things exciting to our clients.